books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we'll chat once again to Beth O'Brien about her Carnegie shortlisted book, Wolf Siren, her new book, Feather Vane, and an inclusive stories tour with Scottish Book Trust. We'll also find out about Monsterland with Nicholas Jubber.
All that and more on today's Read On.
As part of my interviews with the shortlisted authors on this year's Carnegie shortlist, I caught up with visually impaired author Beth O'Brien while she was on a schools tour with the Scottish Book Trust. We'll hear all about Wolf Siren, her new book, and with Signe Rudavica, we'll hear all about the Inclusive Stories Tour. But first, let's remind ourselves of the Carnegie shortlisted Wolf Siren. Back in April 2025, episode 421, if you're hunting for it, we spoke at length about Wolf Siren, the recording at the RNIB Talking Book Studios, and the fact that the narrator was also visually impaired. We'll touch on these things in a moment, but first let's hear from the book as read by Niamh Longford.
There is a moment's pause, filled only with the sound of Miss Blaberry inhaling deeply and releasing her breath slowly. I wait, the words wolf family reverberating through me as though my skin is humming with them. I knew Mira, your grandmother, when she was a young woman. We were both young women. This wasn't the first or last time someone came to me in this predicament. She was in love, and she was pregnant. But she was also unmarried. The father of the child came from a town on the other side of the woods. So, when she realised she was going to have a baby, she went to his home to tell him the good news. But when she got there, his wife answered the door, and there were four children sitting at the dinner table. The wife told Mira that her husband was out hunting and would not be back for some days. The shock was overwhelming for Mira, and she ran from the house back into the woods. She told me she had risked everything to be with him. I tried to comfort her. I told her that I had seen other women in her position and that she would get through it in whatever way she thought best. But she wasn't listening. That's when she told me. She told me she was a wolf woman.
Welcome back to Beth O'Brien. You were on almost a year ago with Wolf Siren. Just before we start, remind us of Wolf Siren.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to be back on RNIB Connect Radio. Almost exactly a year ago, I was on here talking about Wolf Siren, which was my debut novel, which was a reimagining of the fairy tale Little Red Riding Hood, told from the point of view of a visually impaired character, which stemmed from the idea of me wondering why Little Red Riding Hood didn't notice that her grandmother had been replaced by a wolf. And I took that idea and created a whole sort of dark fairy tale retelling.
The silence in the cottage is absolute, as though the very walls are hanging on Miss Blaberry's every word. She lets out a small sigh before continuing. But since Mira had fallen in love with this man, she'd been living a human life almost all the time. She'd been breaking the rule that commanded her kind to only transform into their human form once a month. And he'd never told her he already had a family, nor that he was a hunter, a wolf hunter. As far as she knew, none of her kind had ever conceived a child while human. It simply wasn't done. She came to me because she had heard of my magic, and she hoped I might know some things she didn't. I'd lived in the woods long enough by then to know wolf women existed. When you say wolf women, my mind is fuzzy, thoughts moving as slow as dripping mud. You mean like the ones in grandmother's stories?
And I believe there's been some exciting Carnegie news about Wolf Siren.
Yes, there has been some ridiculously exciting Carnegie news. Wolf Siren was just shortlisted for the 2026 Medal for Writing, which I still can't quite believe. So yeah, but apparently that has happened.
Now, one of the things we do at RNIB is we give the winner of the Carnegie Medal a Braille copy of the book, but you'll already have a Braille copy of Wolf Siren.
Well, you know what? I actually don't, until this week when I'm in Scotland with Scottish Book Trust. The RNIB kindly gave a Braille copy of the manuscript to them for us to show the students. And it's been incredible for them to see sort of the scale of what a Braille book versus a printed book looks like. But I did impress Signa, who is chaperoning me round to many a lovely school in Scotland, by explaining some of the contractions in level 2 Braille and how that all works. So it's been really fun to see it. But I am a RNIB library member, so I think I actually do need to order my own Braille copy on the print on demand lovely service that you do.
Now tell us more about this tour with Scottish Book Trust.
Well, I actually have Signa here with me, who is looking at me like she doesn't want me to draw her into this conversation, but she will be the absolute best person to give you a lowdown of all of the hard work that Scottish Book Trust has put into, firstly, make this happen generally, and also very kindly to have invited me to be a part of it. So I'm going to hand over to Signa and reap the consequences of that later.
Hi, Robert. My name is Signa Radovica, and I work for the Scottish Book Trust. I'm a project manager for a project called Sharing Sensory Stories. And as part of this project, we take authors with lived experience of disability on the Inclusive Stories Tour. We try to see every local authority in Scotland. So because we only have a week at a time of an author's time, we couldn't see every school in Scotland. So we swap out the local authorities every year when we go out on tour.
Now, obviously, Beth is visually impaired, but what other sensory authors have you had on the tour?
For example, last year we worked with an illustrator called Lucy Rogers, who is a deaf person, and she makes these beautiful illustrations in picture books and includes characters that have hearing aids or cochlear implants. And the year before, we went on tour with an author called Lizette Auten, who is a neurodivergent poet and playwright and a children's book author. So we work with people with all kinds of disabilities and neurodiverse conditions. And also, it's important that these authors portray characters with disabilities in their books as well, because I think it's important that children are able to see themselves in the books that they read.
And what have the reactions from the students been?
I think we've had really great reactions so far. So we've seen 4 schools, and first when you go into the classroom, they're all a bit shy and not sure what's going on. But Beth has absolutely charmed, I think, everybody. And by the end of the hour, she has everybody chatting and sharing story ideas. And some people come up to her after the end and tell her about the books they're reading or the stories they're writing themselves.
Yeah, it's been absolutely lovely. Each group has its own sort of dynamic, but overall, the common factor is that they've been incredibly imaginative when they've been coming up with their own fairy tale retellings. And part of what we've been doing is getting them to retell them with a different main character or changing something about the original main character. So it really broadens their idea of who can be the hero and who these stories are for. And it's just been an absolute incredible thing to hear the ideas they come up with and the sheer range of ideas with the same story prompts that these kids come up with. It's been an absolute joy to be a part of it.
We are recording this before the release of your new book, but I think by the time it's broadcast, it will be out. So the perfect chance to tell us about Feather Vein.
Yes, thank you. Feather Vein comes out next week at this time of recording, but it's been so exciting to talk to the students about it. It is a retelling of a folktale called Ceridwen's Cauldron, which is a Celtic folktale. And it's about an enchantress who wants to brew the potion of knowledge and wisdom for her son, who has an unusual appearance, to brew this and to sort of compensate for that. But in my retelling, I tell it from the point of view of the twins, who in the original story are mentioned in the early parts, but then fade into the background and don't really get mentioned again. But I thought they were really interesting characters to explore, and I wanted to change the sort of moral message from one of gaining knowledge and wisdom to compensate for an appearance, to instead be a story about gaining confidence in the body that you have and the differences that you have.
Thanks to my feathers, I've never felt the cold as badly as my mum or sister. Mum was striding off ahead, like always, her long cloak flapping behind her, as though, like us, it was struggling to keep up. It was springtime, but you wouldn't know it from the way my twin sister held her body so tense and huddled into her own cloak. Creerwee is not covered in blue-black feathers like I am. Instead, her arms have short fair hairs. They reflect the sunlight back at the sky, but they do not protect her from the cold like my feathers do.
Now, Ceridwen's Cauldron is quite a Welsh story. Have you kept it based in Wales?
Amazingly, well, it's set in a fantasy world. I've kept the names from the original story. So the boy is called Morfran and the girl is called Creerwee. And I've kept Ceridwen as the main character. Claire Morgan is narrating the audiobook and she reads it beautifully, their voices in Welsh accents. But they travel, this family, they part of the story is that they are assigned magical tasks all over the place to deal with magical issues. So they meet people who are not Welsh, but yes, the Welsh thing is very much at the heart of their characters and absolutely of Claire's narration, which is absolutely beautiful.
Creerwee rubbed her numb hands together the way you would over a fire, only we had no fire because we were walking. We had been walking for a long time. And Mum, who doesn't have feathers either, wasn't showing any signs of slowing down as she led the way with all our worldly belongings bobbing along beside her in midair. There are strict rules against using magic on another living being, whether they be magical creature or human, which is why my mum could make all our things levitate and save us the bother of carrying them, but couldn't brew Creerwee a potion to keep her snug. There were ways around this, if only Mum had thought about it. But her mind always seemed to be on other people's problems. That was when I decided that as soon as I turned 13, in just a few days, and was finally allowed to brew my own magic, I would make a warming potion. I couldn't put the warming potion on Creerwee herself, but I could put it on her coat. I could already imagine Creerwee's voice correcting me.
Its proper name is a Calid concoction, Morfran. You know that.
Now, I know when Niamh Longford narrated Wolf Siren, you went along. Did you travel to see Claire narrating Feathervane?
Robert, I tried. I really wanted to. But Claire couldn't get to London one day, and the other day I was told that there were building works at the RNIB, so Claire was recording from home the other day because she has all the facilities of a home studio at home. So I didn't get to be present for the actual recording of it, but I have been in touch with her. We discussed pronunciations. I got to hear the samples, and I have recorded a letter from the author to go at the end of the audiobook, because as you'll know from when I spoke to you last time, I do love my audiobooks and I like them to have something a little special compared to the print book. So I actually sat with my head in my wardrobe to record a positive, a good message that had enough sound quality to fit in with the quality needed for an audiobook. So I looked crazy, but hopefully it will be worth it when that appears at the end of the audiobook.
Normally at this point, I would ask where the idea for Feathervane came from, but I read a blog post saying you've kind of forgotten.
I forgot how well you actually researched me before I speak to you. Yes, I did write. I did write that. So the idea came from me wanting to retell that folktale. But whereas with Wolf Siren, I have a clear mental memory of where I was, what was going on in my life, and where I even sat and wrote the book. I remember where I wrote specific chapters. With Feathervane, it was, for me as writing it, pure escapism. So to the point that now I really don't have many recollections of sitting at my laptop and typing. I just remember the story growing. I just remember finding out what happens as I wrote and sort of this magical world and what happens in it expanding before me. And it's a bizarre thing for me because it's such a contrast to Wolf Siren, but in terms of what I remember. But I think it was such escapism for me as the writer that I really hope that it can provide that for the reading experience as well. I'll be interested to hear if it does, because for me, it was just a pure joy to escape into this world.
Now, the cover of Wolf Siren was quite gothic, and the Feather Vane is along the same lines. Can you give us a little description of the cover of Feather Vane?
Yeah, so the cover of Feather Vane has the two main characters, Morfran and Creary, and Morfran is covered in feathers on his head and on his arms and on his legs, and Creary has long red hair and is wearing a blue dress. And they're standing either side of a potion which has like yellowish light emanating from around it. And they seem to be in what looks like a sort of cave that disappears deeper behind them. Around the cover, there is lots of falling blue feathers. There's fairies. On the back cover, there is a spooky looking river hag. Eyes are just visible over the water. And there's a windmill turning on the back cover as well. And I think it's also on the back cover, there is a fiery little salamander in one of the corners. So from that description, your readers can expect that there will be a lot of magical creatures in this book.
Now, we know you're a visually impaired writer, so some of our own writers listening may be interested in some of the tech you use. So can you tell us a little bit about VoiceDream?
Oh, yes. I feel like I should get commission from VoiceDream. I tell everybody about it. I love it. So I use it. I have it on my laptop and my phone and my iPad. I have it on all of my devices. And it's a screen reader app in a sense, but it just reads documents. But you can upload documents that are just an image and convert it into a OCR PDF. So the text will then be read aloud. You can adjust the like margins and the width and the size and the font and all of that. So that's really helpful. And you can convert documents into plain text so that it's just continuously scrolling. And I use it all the time. You can highlight and easily find your highlights. It's how I proofread all of my books using this app. I play it aloud while holding it near my eyes to try and read as much as I can or spot typos that phonetically sound right when I listen to them, but are literally wrong. Yeah, I can't praise it enough, but I don't get commission. So it's not a paid ad. This is just me using it. And I've used it for years. I used it through uni and I use it for my writing life. It's incredible.
Feather Vane and indeed Wolf Siren are both available in print as an ebook and in audio commercially. And they're both available in audio and braille from RNIB Talking Books. Thanks again to Beth and to Cigna. For more information on the Scottish Book Trust, the Inclusive Stories Tour, or all the things they do, you can head to Scottish Book Trust, all one word, scottishbooktrust.com. And both Beth and Cigna will be back at the end of today's show in a double Books of My Life.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
So far on Read On, we've talked to J.P. Rose about Birdie, to Katja Balin about Ghost Lines, to Tia Fisher about Not Going to Plan, to Rob Harrell about Popcorn, to Jason Reynolds about 24 Seconds from Now, and of course to Beth Bryan about Wolf Siren. The final two authors on the Carnegie shortlist are unfortunately not giving interviews, who are William Hussey and Patrick Ness. William Hussey's book is called The Boy I Love.
A grunting, gasping, clanging chaos of engines. Bursts of white smoke that remind me of shell vapour streaming across a foreign field. The platform at St Pancras swarms with railway porters and staff officers checking and loading supplies bound for the front. Tinned food, canvas tents, barrels of rum, scratchy blankets, crates of ammunition packed by lemon-skinned girls poisoned by their work in the munitions factories. Meanwhile, parents stand behind the ticket barrier, summoning their last scraps of courage, letting go of their sons with lingering handshakes and tearful smiles.
Patrick Ness's book is called Chronicles of a Lizard Nobody.
I have a question, Daniel said. Is it true you can use your butt as armor? Yes, said Principal Wombat. It's a wombat thing. Anything else? What if they don't have a hall pass and they don't want to go see you? Zeke asked. Then you take down their name and you tell me they didn't want to go. Zeke thought about this. This isn't going to make us very popular. But you'll be serving the school, Principal Wombat smiled, and you'll be making me happy.
So that's all 8 books on this year's shortlist for the Carnegie Medal for Writing. The ceremony is in a few short weeks, so we'll let you know who's won one of the most prestigious prizes for children's writing in the UK and indeed the world as soon as we can. Now, last time Beth was on Read On, I also played an interview with Nicholas Jubber about the Fairy Tellers. Well, at last year's Wigtown Book Festival, I interviewed Nicholas again, this time about his book, Monsterland. Monsters, in all their terrifying glory, have preoccupied humans since we began telling stories. But where did these stories come from? In Monsterland, award-winning author Nicholas Jubber goes on a journey to discover more about the monsters we've invented, lurking in the dark and the wild places of the earth. Giants, dragons, ogres, zombies, ghosts, demons. All with one thing in common, their ability to terrify. His far-ranging adventure takes him across the world. He sits on the thrones of giants in Cornwall, visits the shrine of a beheaded ogre near Kyoto, travels to an 18th century Balkan vampire's forest dwelling, and paddles among the shapeshifters of the Louisiana bayous. On his travels, he discovers that the stories of the people and places that birthed them are just as fascinating as the creatures themselves. Nick was last on Read On with his book The Fairy Tellers, which he narrated himself. But this time around, the audio version of Monsterland is narrated by Charles Armstrong.
Snow was falling over the mountains. It shrouded the trees and hooded the rocks. It smeared the roofs in the village below and speckled the river like the spots on a wild beast's pelt. It was just the kind of weather you'd expect on the day when the monsters are coming. There they were, stomping down the stony, snow-laden path towards me. Some were fanned by feathers, others obscured by fleece. Under pinhole eyes rimmed with colour, bear-like snouts bulged and bony fangs curled out of mouths as red as the horns on their heads. Spring comes late to the Rodopi Mountains. The streets were still rinking, the low piles capped with snow. The monsters were better at negotiating the slopes than me, so I flatten myself against the stone walls of my host Ilya's house and watch them go by. Cowbells tinkled from their horns. Bronze clappers rattled on their knees, the sort of clanging you'd expect to hear if a metal gate had been flung open. We called them kukri. It goes back to the ancient Thracians. Ilya's eyes flashed in his broad, beaming face. Dionysus and all his parties. That's what it is. It's celebration. The kukri are about life. Behind him, a mask hung from a nail, over an old saddle and a woodpile. A beard of silky black goat hair spilled from a face tessellated with pieces of bone. Apotropaic, an image of evil warding off the evil outside. A lesson in the ambiguity of folk monsters and the stories we tell about them.
Well, it's the story of my journey around monsters around the world, across 4 continents and a dozen different countries, and it's exploring stories going back into ancient times right the way through into the 20th century and beyond, and looking at how stories of monsters have changed across the ages, but also how different monster stories are told in lots of different cultures around the world and what connections we can find between those stories. So it's a book about the connections between cultures and time, but also about the distinctiveness within them.
The square of Shiroka Laka was their destination, the heart of a Bulgarian mountain village. Count all the eyes fixed on the monsters, 1,000 and rising. The kukeri swung around each other, leaped and tumbled. Like animals taking over the farm, they yoked themselves to a wooden plough and drove it around the square. Others held up a wooden spindle, a stump of wood painted red. Their name remains a mystery. Some derive it from kuka, Proto-Slavic for evil spirit, others from the Latin for hood. But the longer I watched them, the less they seemed like evil spirits, more like distorted mirrors for humanity. Guided by their leader, who had antler-like horns and went by the tongue-twisting title of Beul-Yuk-Bashir, they were acting out a cosmic drama handed down from generation to generation. It plays out like some burlesque variation on a Greek tragedy. Over here, the Kukeri roll on the ground, conical hoods swaying like sheaves of corn in the breeze, a chorus in mime to the scattering of grain. This is Kukaroften, the day of the Kuka, a spell without words, dramatizing the cycle of life and death, rapture and pain. Of course it brings us together. This is the purpose. Late in the evening, one of the Kukeri faced me in the village bar. Poor man. He was having to field questions from the gangly, pasty-faced fellow from way out of town. With his mask on the table between us, he took a swig from a bottle of Kushovitse beer. It is in our blood. My father did it also, and my grandfather. The best thing is not what you can see. For us, it is the time we are practicing. What does it feel like, I asked, when you're in the mask, when you become a Kuka? Do you feel different? He shrugged, took a sip of his beer while I was rephrasing the question. But another Kuka leaned across his shoulder. I know what you say. Something, when we put the mask on, something happens to us. In life, even when everything is... He screwed his fist together, showing how dark things can get. Still, when the mask is on, then we are... One hand grasped at the air, as if the word was hiding in the rafters, and his eyes lit up when he found it. Free.
So is there like a werewolf legend in various countries and, say, a vampire legend in various countries?
Well, yeah, vampires and werewolves are two monsters that crop up all over the place. I mean, we're talking here in Wigton, where there's a story of the vampire Annan from not very far from here, which was recorded by William of Newburgh in the 12th century, I think. So, yeah, vampire stories do crop up all over the place. With the vampire chapter, I focus specifically on the root of the word vampire, which comes from the Serbo-Croat. So I've gone to the Balkans there, and I spent a night in a vampire's a haunted mill, which is supposed to be haunted by a vampire from the 18th century called Sava Savanovic, and talked to a lot of people there about some of the vampire stories that emerged, especially in the 17th and 18th century. It was said in the 1730s by Voltaire, the great French satirist, that nothing was spoken of more than vampires. So there were a huge number of stories that many people believed to be true that were emerging in that particular time. And throughout the book, I've sort of looked at particular moments in history where particular monsters have a sort of vogue. So it's vampires in the 18th century. With werewolves, it's France in the 1600s, when there was a sort of spate of stories about werewolves. There were people brought up before the high courts and in places like Bordeaux, accused of either being werewolves or behaving like them, and then getting locked up as being insane. So it was a time, it's often the case, I think, throughout history, that when there's a time of political turmoil and there's a lot of trouble going on, that people start accusing others of being monsters and witches and dabbling in demonic crafts. And we see that even today with some of the accusations that get slung at each other from different sides of political spectrums, and in some of the rhetoric that comes out of our present day war zones. So I think it's always there. But yeah, there are certain monsters that seem to really become really resonant at particular moments in history.
As far back as we can go, there they are, waiting for us. 40,000 years ago or so, a figure known today as the Löwenmensch, or Lion Man, was carved from a mammoth's tusk in the Swabian Jura, a bipedal theriomorph combining features of human and beast. In the oldest written tale, the 4,000-year-old Sumerian Epic of Gilgamesh, the eponymous hero confronts the forest guardian Humbaba the Terrible, a tusked giant born from a mountain, whose speech is fire, and his breath is death. The Bible tells of Behemoth, the chaos monster at the beginning of creation. Browse the pages of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and you'll come across wrathful deities with the heads of wild beasts, garlands of snakes, and corpses over their shoulders, stirring the cycle of existence with their lions' manes and bulging eyes. The stories of the ancient world can be so boggy, with their arcane rites and auguries, baffling hierarchies and obsession with honour. It's a challenge to find an accessible entry point. What guides us in, again and again, are the monsters. Odysseus and his crew trying not to get eaten by the Cyclops. The Hindu hero Rama and his monkey army battling demonic Rakshasas. The great northern strongman Beowulf ripping the clawed arm from the fen beast Grendel's shoulder. A few things may have changed over the millennia, but our fascination for monsters isn't one of them. What is different, however, is the way that we perceive the monsters. For the people who told those long-ago tales, they were more than mere fodder for heroic deeds. They were palpable threats to life, and even more worryingly, the afterlife, liable at any moment to tear through the flimsy barrier between our world and theirs.
Was there anything you discovered that was unique to one culture, like a monster you'd never heard of?
Well, Japan has a lot of monsters. I mean, they have an incredible sort of menagerie of monsters going back across centuries. So some of them were seemed very distinctive. You have the one of the monsters is it manifests as a sort of boy holding a piece of tofu and trying to sort of lure you in with the tofu. So that's one of their yokai, as they call them over there. So there were quite a few that came that I heard about there that I hadn't heard of before, and certainly, you know, really, you know, some of them, you know, very sort of mind-blowing. But also they have a lot of monsters that are very distinctive, like the Oni is the one that I focus on in Japan, which is a sort of horned, shape-shifting, flesh-eating monster. And they've been telling stories about Oni over more than 1,000 years. But it's very distinctively Japanese, but it also has things in common with sort of ogre-like creatures in many different cultures. And I'm often fascinated both by what makes these creatures distinctive and then also what connects them up with stories that are being told elsewhere.
And where you actually travel into these different locations?
Yes, yeah, I went to all the places that I wrote about. I felt that as a writer of sort of travel stroke history stroke folklore, that it's important to go to the places, but also because you get to meet people there. A lot of the book is about how communities gather around stories of monsters. So you have, for example, the Dragon of Bavaria, of a place called Furfenwald, which is a town that they call themselves the Drakenstadt, the town of the dragon, because they've had a dragon parade since at least 1590 AD and probably even further back than then. And it's been going on every year. They parade the dragon through the town, and then somebody from the town is chosen as the dragon slayer. And now it's the world's largest walking robot that's made for a huge amount of money by various special effects companies. The past, obviously, it was a bit simpler than that. But it brings people together. You have 1,000 people dressed up in medieval and ancient garb, and then you have huge crowds of people who come to see it, and it unites people. Same in with the Werewolf of Louisiana, which I researched about, the Rougarou. You have a festival there called the Rougarou Fest, and it's an area in the south of Louisiana where they've been going through a lot of difficulty with Hurricane Ida a couple of years ago, and the devastation from that, you know, huge number of people losing their homes or their homes being wrecked. So it doesn't compensate for that, but certainly having this festival, I think, was a way for a lot of people to sort of come together and to celebrate their sense of community.
Was there ever a point where you were scared?
Well, I spent a night in a vampire's mill in Serbia. So this is a place called Zorozhe, which is associated with the story of a vampire called Sava Savanovic. And the story is that he was a miller who was killed after murdering a woman that he was in love with, and then hidden away, and people forgot about him. They sort of buried him far from the village. And then the mill was haunted. People couldn't go and grind their flour, so they had to try and find out the name of the vampire, which they eventually did, and then they were able to slay him. So I thought that it would be interesting to spend the night in that mill, but because I hadn't reckoned for just how scary it would become. But that was the test, really. It was the challenge, because I didn't think I believed in vampires. But certainly spending the whole night in that little sort of creaky wooden mill over this beautiful gushing river. But, you know, everything gets rather sinister as dark takes over, and you can hear the nightjars chirring and the owls shrieking, and just wondering what is it that's making that noise up in the roof of the mill there. And it's amazing what it does to your imagination. So that was an exciting experience, and I think I was very, very grateful when the first glimmer of light appeared over the horizon, and I took that as a sign that my night was over and I could now leave. I think it was about 4:30 in the morning at that point. I was like, yeah, that's it, I'm done. But then actually what I hadn't accounted for was the possibility of dogs, which they're then barking at me all the way as I made my way back to the main road to get the one daily bus back to Belgrade. And I think the barking of the dogs was almost as scary as what I was imagining inside the mill.
With the age of science, the traditional monsters found themselves against an insuperable barrier, dismissed from reality and excluded from scientific taxonomies. They were confined to the zone of storytelling, glamorous afterimages of dying or disempowered cultures. As we shall see, some of the most powerful manifestations of monsters exist in this limbo state, representing historical memories of times long past, emotional connections with periods of seismic change and traumatic loss. But the world keeps turning, and in the industrialized world, a new perception of monsters emerged. In a world less and less convinced of their existence, they became monetized spectacles, marshalled for a rapidly increasing range of mass media. From macabre bloodsuckers in penny dreadfuls to stop-motion, rubber-suited, or latterly CGI movie behemoths, monsters have taken pride of place in commercial storytelling.
Now, we heard clips of Charles Armstrong reading the book. Were you responsible in any way for his casting?
I mean, I was given a veto. That was, I think that was all really.
Do you not fancy doing it yourself?
I do, yeah. I did my last book, actually. But I think, you know, sometimes you get the opportunity and sometimes you don't. It just depends on circumstances.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from an online source is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of Monsterland?
Oh, I think it's a beautiful cover. It combines a variety of different imagery of sort of all, I think all of the monsters in the book are included in it. It's got the vampire, the ogre, the oni, the selkies, who a little bit of Scottish mythology in the book, and many others. So it's really beautifully designed.
Did you come away with a favourite monster?
I've always loved dragons for their sort of splendour, their combination of different elements, their ability to breathe fire, but also to fly, and their sort of the scale. And I think I grew up loving a lot of dragon stories like The Hobbit and so on. So I think they've always been quite a favourite. But I think that in the course of writing and researching the book, I found myself drawn to each of the monsters in turn. Certainly very intrigued by vampires, although I've always found them quite creepy. I grew to love Godzilla, the Japanese film monster who featured in, I think, more movies than any other franchise monster, and is an extraordinary, both an extraordinary creation visually, but also an extraordinary representation of Japanese history and culture. So, yeah, there's a sort of, I think that in the course of doing the book, there's become a little part of my heart for each of them.
This doesn't mean the old fears have been fully suppressed, or at least in being suppressed, they still have a knack for finding outlets. In an irony that says much about the twisty path of the monster story, science, which had done so much to smother the old beliefs, became the most fertile source of our modern fears and inspiration for new hordes. Now, instead of being spawned by gods or magic spells, monsters draw their power from electrolysis, poisonous chemicals, neutron radiation, fossil fuel extraction, cloning technology. Or they travel across the stars, alerted to our planet by the signals we're relentlessly broadcasting. Punishments for human hubris, these new monsters transform our scientific achievements into visions of the apocalypse that will eventually engulf us.
Monsterland, a journey around the world's dark imagination, written by Nicholas Jobber and narrated by Charles Armstrong, is available now from wherever you buy your audiobooks.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Every weekday on RNIB Connect Radio, we bring you a classic RNIB talking book, serialised and played in full over time.
The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde.
The Old Curiosity Shop by Charles Dickens.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson.
You'll hear much-loved novels and timeless favourites brought to life by some truly brilliant narrators who know
How to Let a Story Breathe.
Hello, I'm Richard Burnett.
Hello, I'm John Cormack.
Hello, I'm Garrick Hagan.
Join us every weekday at 2 p.m. with a repeat at 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
I'm Michael Palin, and you're listening to Talking Books
only on RNIB Connect Radio.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's Read On, let's return to both Beth and Signa for a double Books of Your Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
There are so many, and I'm trying to remember what I told you last time when you asked me these questions, because I'm famously bad at picking favourites. But I was a massive Harry Potter book fan as a child. Those books definitely got me reading, especially longer books.
Get the post, Dudley, said Uncle Vernon from behind his paper.
Make Harry get it.
Get the post, Harry.
Make Dudley get it.
Poke him with your smelting stick, Dudley. Harry dodged the smelting stick and went to get the post. Three things lay on the doormat. A postcard from Uncle Vernon's sister Marge, who was holidaying on the Isle of Wight, a brown envelope that looked like a bill, and a letter for Harry. Harry picked it up and stared at it, his heart twanging like a giant elastic band. No one ever in his whole life had written to him. Who would? He had no friends, no other relatives. He didn't belong to the library, so he'd never even got rude notes asking for books back. Yet here it was, a letter, addressed so plainly there could be no mistake. Mr. H. Potter, The Cupboard Under the Stairs, 4 Privet Drive, Little Winging, Surrey. The envelope was thick and heavy, made of yellowish parchment, and the address was written in emerald green ink. There was no stamp. Turning the envelope over, his hand trembling, Harry saw a purple wax seal bearing a coat of arms, a lion, an eagle, a badger, and a snake surrounding a large letter H. "Hurry up, boy!" shouted Uncle Vernon from the kitchen. "What are you doing, checking for letter bombs?" He chuckled at his own joke. Harry went back to the kitchen, still staring at his letter. He handed Uncle Vernon the bill and the postcard, sat down, and slowly began to open the yellow envelope. Uncle Vernon ripped open the bill, snorted in disgust, and flipped over the postcard. "Marge is ill," he informed Aunt Petunia, "at a funny whelk."
"Dad," said Dudley suddenly, "Dad, Harry's got something."
Harry was on the point of unfolding his letter, which was written on the same heavy parchment as the envelope, when it was jerked sharply out of his hand by Uncle Vernon.
"That's mine," said Harry, trying to snatch it back.
"Who'd be writing to you?" sneered Uncle Vernon, shaking the letter open with one hand and glancing at it. His face went from red to green faster than a set of traffic lights. And it didn't stop there. Within seconds, it was the greyish white of old porridge. "Julia," he gasped.
My favourite book from my childhood is something pretty obscured, Kit, because I think it was originally published in French and then translated into the little-known Latvian. It was a book called The Adventures of Rikki, which is a fun word to say. It was about a little bear-type dog that went on various kind of childlike adventures. And I really loved it because my grandmother used to read it out loud to me, to the point where whenever I saw her coming round to our house, I would cry out, "Rikki." She eventually became known by this name. So it's a book that holds a dear place in my heart.
I did try, but the only reference to the adventures of Rikki I could find was on a Rare Books website. However, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone and all of the Harry Potter books are available from RNIB Talking Books. That one was read by Stephen Fry. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
I think I might have given the same answer last time, but for me, it's Anne of Green Gables. I love it and I laugh out loud every time I read it. It's just so wholesome and cozy, but with emotion and warmth. I love it. That would be my rainy day. Definitely will cheer me up, read.
You don't look as if there was much to you. But you're wiry. I don't know, but the wiry ones are the best after all. Well, if I take you, you'll have to be a good girl. You know, good and smart and respectful. I'll expect you to earn your keep, and no mistake about that. Yes, I suppose I might as well take her off your hands, Miss Cuthbert. The baby's awful fractious, and I'm clear worn out attending to him. If you like, I can take her right home now. Marilla looked at Anne, and softened at the sight of the child's pale face with its look of mute misery. The misery of a helpless little creature who find itself once more caught in the trap from which it had escaped. Marilla felt an uncomfortable conviction that if she denied the appeal of that look, it would haunt her to her dying day. Moreover, she did not fancy Mrs. Blewett to hand a sensitive, high-strung child over to such a woman. No, she could not take the responsibility of doing that. "Well, I don't know," she said slowly. "I didn't say that Matthew and I had absolutely decided that we wouldn't keep her. In fact, I may say that Matthew is disposed to keep her. I just came over to find out how the mistake had occurred. I think I'd better take her home again and talk it over with Matthew. I feel that I oughtn't to decide on anything without consulting him. If we make up our mind not to keep her, we'll bring her or send her over to you tomorrow night. If we don't, you may know that she is going to stay with us. Will that suit you, Mrs. Blewett?" "I suppose it'll have to."
That's such a great answer. Moving from a classic book, Anne of Green Gables, my favorite rainy day book would be The House in the Cerulean Sea by T.J. Clune, which is a bit of fantasy mixed with kind of real coziness, where a man moves away from this grey concrete city into the countryside, to the seaside, where he meets a family of orphans who have powers. Let's say that they have various powers, and they go on to have adventures together and save the orphanage. And there's also a love story in there as well, so I would definitely recommend.
"Oh dear," Linus Baker said, wiping the sweat from his brow. "This is most unusual." That was an understatement. He watched in rapt wonder as an 11-year-old girl named Daisy levitated blocks of wood high above her head. The blocks spun in slow, concentric circles. Daisy frowned in concentration. The tip of her tongue stuck out between her teeth. It went on for a good minute before the blocks slowly lowered to the floor. Her level of control was astounding. "I see," Linus said, furiously scribbling on his pad of paper. They were in the master's office, a tidy room with government-issued brown carpet and old furniture. The walls were lined with terrible paintings of lemurs in various poses. The master had showed them off proudly, telling Linus painting was her passion, and that if she hadn't become the master of this specific orphanage, she'd be traveling with a circus as a lemur trainer, or even have opened up a gallery to share her artwork with the world. Linus believed the world was better off with the paintings staying in this room, but he kept the thought to himself. He wasn't there to engage in amateur art criticism. "And how often do you, make things float?" The master of the orphanage, a squat woman with frizzy hair, stepped forward.
"Oh, not often at all," she said quickly.
She wrung her hands, eyes darting back and forth.
"Perhaps once or twice a year?"
Linus coughed.
"A month?"
the woman amended.
"Silly me. I don't know why I said a year. Slip of the tongue. Yes, once or twice a month. You know how it is. The older the children get, the more they do things."
"Is that right?" Linus asked Daisy.
"Oh, yes," Daisy said. "Once or twice a month and no more."
She smiled beatifically at him. And Linus wondered if she'd been coached on her answers before his arrival. It wouldn't be the first time it had happened, and he doubted it'd be the last.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library, along with all the books in the series. This one was book one in the series, and it's read by Sarah Mennell. And The House in the Cerulean Sea by T.J. Clune is available in audio commercially, as read by Daniel Henning. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
Yes, there is the short answer. The book is Mona's Eyes, and it is a story about a girl who has 52 weeks before losing her eyesight, and her grandfather is put in charge of arranging therapy for her. But what he does instead is takes her to a different art gallery around France, and they just sit and look at art together. And considering it's all text, this book, it was the most in-depth insight I've got into some of the most famous paintings that physically I can't see in that much detail. And it was a beautiful read just from that alone. I was eager for the narrative to move on to where they got to their next art gallery visit to learn more about the artists and the descriptions of the work they saw. So I would really recommend that as such a great way to access art in a way that I never have before. It was incredible.
Another portrait, Mona commented after 11 minutes, like that of the gypsy girl. And here too you can clearly see the strokes of paint. I mean the really thick ones. The gypsy girl was all cheery. He just looked sad. But there's still something similar about the two of them. Well, Mona, you do impress me. This is only the 7th work we've come to see, and hey presto, you're starting to develop an eye. The Gypsy Girl was by Frans Hals, and this painting is a portrait of the artist Rembrandt, by himself, so a self-portrait, a genre that was pretty new at the time, first emerging around 1500. Rare were the self-portraits in which the artist dared to depict himself in his studio, tools in hand. That's the case in this one, which Rembrandt painted at the age of 54. He was born 2 decades after Frans Hals, in 1606 to be precise, but the two men did know each other and belonged, as you rightly spotted, to one and the same school, the Dutch school of the 17th century. Frans Hals spent his entire career in Haarlem, whereas Rembrandt, originally from the university town of Leiden, soon went up to Amsterdam, a bustling, prosperous port that received goods from all over the world, which thrilled the artist. You can't see it here, but among the 40-odd self-portraits Rembrandt painted, from his youth to his death in 1669, there are many in which he dresses himself up in Oriental costumes, finery or armour, all outlandish accessories he'd buy at fairs or auctions and collect. Rembrandt would have been a good customer for Daddy. Absolutely. In fact, like your father, Rembrandt was also a dealer. On the ground floor of his large house in the Jewish quarter of Amsterdam, he had his own store, selling his own paintings and engravings, but also those by other artists. That house can still be visited today, you know. I'd really love to go there. You will, Mona. Be patient.
My recommendation of a recent read would be Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity by Steve Silberman. So it's a book that's been around for a good couple of years by now and has received some awards as well. So it's fairly well known, but it's a nonfiction book about, well, neurotribes and the history of autism, how it's remembered in modern times. And it's very compelling because it's told through various personal stories of significant people in the past who may or may not have had autism. That's still under discussion, but it's very, very readable for a nonfiction book.
It's hard to imagine the state of the modern world if these two remarkable scientists had never lived. Many aspects of life that we currently take for granted might never have been invented. Both men may have wondered at times if they had accidentally been born on the wrong planet, among chatty, well-intentioned creatures who wasted precious time trying to impress, flatter, outwit, and seduce each other. But their atypical minds were uncannily suited to the work they were born to do. They lived their lives in ways that were as precise, ritualized, and methodical as their experiments. In 2001, neurologist Oliver Sacks proposed that he had uncovered the elusive solution to the problem of Cavendish in a condition that had fascinated him for decades. Writing for his peers in the journal Neurology, he observed that accounts of the reclusive lord's seemingly inexplicable idiosyncrasies, his striking literalness and directness of mind, extreme single-mindedness, and passion for calculation and quantitative exactitude, coupled with a virtual incomprehension of social behaviors and human relationships, closely resembled descriptions of adults with a type of autism called Asperger's syndrome, first described in America in the 1994 edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Sacks also pointed out, however, that it was precisely these qualities that made Cavendish such a brilliant and prolific researcher. His singularities were inextricable from his genius.
Mona's Eyes by Thomas Schlesser is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Holly Lucas. And Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and How to Think Smarter About People Who Think Differently, by Steve Silberman, is also available in the RNIB library, as read by Hayward Morse. That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, every episode is available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.